Welcome to The Dividing Line. It is someday. Who knows what day it is? We've all lost track of what time it is. We're all stuck inside our houses, and the world is ending. And we're all watching movies about viruses. And I remember one movie I saw on a Saturday afternoon. And on, remember TV, when Channel 5 had the Saturday afternoon movie you could watch and things like that, years and years and years ago. And it was 3,000 years to Earth, I think is what it was called. And they found this Martian thing. And at the end, everybody's being turned into zombies by the Martians, and they're chasing people around. That's sort of like where we are now, except we forgot the Martians. So, yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. But good to have you with us today. We have a bunch of things to talk about. Let me start off with saying what I said yesterday on Twitter in the morning. I specifically said something along the lines of not meeting for worship yesterday was not a violation of Hebrews 10:25, and meeting for worship yesterday was not a violation of the sixth commandment. The totalitarians are on our doorstep, and we're inside gouging each other's eyes out. And, of course, I had some people saying, well, Mr. Pot, meet Mr. Kettle or something. I have no idea what that was about. But the attempted communication, the attempted idea that I was trying to communicate, is I would say probably the most disappointing thing about this past weekend was the fact that you saw this massive schism. And the edges of the schism started shooting at each other, which I guess is not unusual in social media. But that's what was taking place. And so you had, literally people on one side saying that if you're meeting for church, you're murdering people and you should never be trusted again and you're an idiot and so on and so forth. And on the other side, you had people saying you're just straight up violating scripture. And Hebrews 10:25 says you have to have church on Sunday morning, evidently, or something. And so when I saw all of this going on, there were a couple times I did step in and say something when I saw someone quoting from the one side, the you need to meet side. That's not what Hebrews 10:25 is about. Hebrews 10:25 is specifically talking about people who absent themselves from the stated meetings of the church because they don't want to be under authority. They don't want to. They're not concerned about the ordinances. Maybe they just think they're better off by themselves doing whatever. It's really nothing about a question of what to do when facing a situation as we are facing right now. And in fact, to my knowledge, there isn't anything in the New Testament about that. And so you can look at church history, and I've seen Luther being quoted and Spurgeon being quoted because of the fact that if you did not meet for church out of a, what's the term, abundance of caution, there would have been no church services until probably the 1950s. Up until that point in time, you had so many things running around. You had polio back at the beginning of the last century. You had meningitis and tuberculosis and cholera, a huge cholera plague in London during Spurgeon's ministry. And of course, you had things like the Black Death. The plague was a from 1347 onward, somewhere in Europe, the plague was a constant reality until modern times. And so, obviously, the you can look to church history and you can ask for wisdom from the past, but to try to make the argument that, you know, we should be shooting people and insulting people and everything else, shooting people spiritually, which is what Christians are good at, spiritual shooting, was really disappointing to me. It really, really was. Trust me, I know the elders of your church are struggling with these issues and are seriously and prayerfully considering these issues. Okay? And they're going to come up, they're going to come to different conclusions. And so if you're not an elder in that particular church, then just say, I'll pray for you and move along. You don't, why do you have to make some negative comment? Why do you have to? From either side, I don't get it. I don't understand it. Don't we have enough going on right now? I think we've got enough going on right now. We've got a lot going on right now. Let's just put it that way. I want to ask you to think about something here. I haven't had the time really to see what kind of responses this has gotten on Twitter. I don't think that it's actually gotten much. But I posted this on Twitter, and I just asked people to consider it, to give consideration to what is in this graphic. I went online, went to the CDC. Man, that website was slow. That was interesting. And I pulled off this graphic. Now, this is for 2017, so I guess they're just behind getting all the numbers for 2018 and 2019 tabulated. That's pretty slow, but close enough. Death and mortality, the data are for the U.S., the United States of America. In 2017, 2.8 million people died in the United States. Now, let's just stop right there. 2.8 million people. Did you know that? Had you given any thought to it? Has it ever crossed your mind to wonder how many people die per day in the nation, let alone of what? But the point is 2.8 million, over 2.8 million people died in the United States. That's a lot of funerals. Lot of funerals, 2.8 million. Just divide that by 365 for your daily numbering. And the number of deaths for leading causes of death is what I was especially looking for. And that's about halfway down there. You have almost 650,000 heart disease. Cancer, just under 600,000. So between the two of them, you have 1.25 million. So that's a huge number. That's almost half of all the deaths in the United States, heart disease and cancer. Now, obviously, there's lots of different kinds of heart disease. Heart attack would obviously be probably the biggest killer there, heart failure of various kinds. Cancer, there's all sorts of different kinds of cancer. But think about it for a moment. The heart attack, the heart disease one probably died of a heart attack. But obviously, if you have cardiac issues, that can impact all sorts of other aspects of your health too. Cancer, very often just so degrades the body that you become how many people, and how do you count this? How do you make these decisions? How many people died of pneumonia that was brought on by radiation and chemotherapy because it destroyed your immune system and something else got you? Is that counted under the cancer section or under the influenza and pneumonia section? I don't know. The point is that people die of things, and they are often very complicated things. So the next one is chronic lower respiratory disease. Oh, I'm sorry. The next one is accidents, unintentional injuries, 170,000 people. Now, I know that the traffic accident death toll was only in the 30s, upper 30s maybe. Last year it was right at 300 and it was almost exactly 100 per day for 2019. So that means there's a whole lot of other stuff going on. I suppose this would include train crashes and airplane crashes and people falling off buildings and out of windows and your parachute didn't open when you did a parachute jump or whatever. There's a lot of things that can take people out. 170,000 deaths. And very close to that, chronic lower respiratory disease is 160,000. Stroke, 146,000. Alzheimer's in the top 10. 121,000. Diabetes, 83.5. Almost 84,000. And then you have influenza and pneumonia. So why put them together? Aren't they separate things? Normally, the way a flu gets you is by opening the way for the pneumonia to get into your lungs with all the coughing and inflammation and so on and so forth. And certainly in the olden days, pneumonia was called the old man's best friend because you could be suffering horribly and it's pneumonia that would take you. Even though that's not what caused your death. Almost no one who dies of pneumonia was out running a marathon the day before, and then bang, they get hit with pneumonia and they're gone. That's unusual. There's, in so many of these, there will be underlying health issues. So, for example, nephritis, nephrotic syndrome, and nephrosis, those are kidney diseases. Well, if you've fried your kidneys as an excessive indulger in alcohol, what actually got you? Kidney disease or the alcohol? I mean, those are important questions. Intentional self-harm, suicide, 47,000 people. Think about all the complicating factors there. How many did that because of underlying disease issues? How many did that because of drug abuse issues? You can see how maybe it does take a long time to tally these things up and figure out which one goes in what category in any meaningful sense. But what we see is that in many of these, there are underlying conditions that give rise to the final thing that gives the coup de grace. So which one do you blame that on? Well, that's one of the questions. We die of complicated things. I mean, you know, when a 20-year-old dies in a high-speed car accident and drugs and alcohol are involved, well, okay, it was the high-speed car accident that did it. There's probably not other things involved. Unless they just broke up with their girlfriend or something and they commit suicide. So even what look like clear, obvious things may have complicating attachments to it. Why do I mention this? Well, first of all, we don't think much about it. I don't know how many years it's been that I have been saying that we, even in the church, stink at discussing death. Even in the church. Some of you know that my second best-selling book, actually, or at least most widely distributed, I'm not sure how many times it's been just simply given away. I know it was being given away at Ground Zero by September 13th of 2001, a little book that I wrote on grieving. It came from my years of working as a hospital chaplain, toughest work I've ever done. And because I wrote that book, I have said over and over and over again that Americans as a whole, and Christian Americans as well, stink at discussing death. We have embraced the same attitude as our culture. We hide from death. We don't talk about death. We don't know nearly as much as we should about the grieving process and why grieving is natural and what the stages of grieving are and things like that. So I come at that with a known perspective and a known track record, shall we say. So we don't talk about it, and we don't realize how many people die in the United States. And so when someone comes on the media and says, we could have 10,000 people die, that would be 1/65th of the number of people who will die of heart disease this year. 1/65th. So, you know, that's as far as accidents, that's, you know, that's 1/16th, 1/17th of the people who die of accidents. And you go, you're making light of 10,000 people dying. No, I'm putting it into a context, because if we don't know the numbers, then we can be given a false context. And then if we don't know the facts, then people can manipulate the facts to try to control us. That's the first thing. So knowledge is a good thing. Having knowledge is a good thing. But here's the real discussion that you need to have. And hey, some of you have plenty of time to be having discussions right now. And that's a good thing. But the discussion you have to have is, every society makes a decision as to where you're going to draw the line when it comes to danger, when it comes to the danger of death. Every society. And I think what's happening right now is that line is being strongly questioned. And since we've never thought about it, we're not in a position to even begin to analyze what that means. Let me give you an example. In the 19th century, no one ever had to worry about the responsibility that would be theirs to get into an automobile and possibly cause the death of one or more people by the fact that you're in an automobile. Every automobile you drive is a deadly weapon. I know people who have been in a vehicle, with driving a vehicle, that killed someone. May not have been their fault. May have been. Those people are changed tremendously by that experience. But the fact is, if you have ever gotten into a car and driven, you made the decision. You may have been ignorant of the fact you were making the decision. For most of us, 15 years, 7 months, we're ignorant of a lot of stuff. We're not even thinking about things down the road. But you made a decision. And that decision was that my reasons for getting in this vehicle and going someplace outweigh the chances that I am going to take someone's life or my own life is going to be taken. Otherwise, you wouldn't drive. Otherwise, you would, well, even if you take public transportation, people get run over by buses all the time. It happens. Buses are involved in accidents. People die in accidents with buses. And so if you're on a bus and you hit a car and a baby dies in the car, are you not in some sense responsible? Because you were on the bus. Well, not directly. Yeah, but the bus wouldn't be running if you weren't using public transportation, right? So we all make decisions. And we make decisions that our freedom to move about and to obtain food, employment, and let's be honest, a lot of time, pleasure. We're going someplace to see a movie, right? Going someplace to see a movie. You get in the car, you're taking a risk. You are endangering your life and the life of others around you. And we have decided in our society that that is an acceptable risk. That the numbers are such that, yeah, it's going to happen. And nearly 40,000 people will lose their lives in car accidents this year. It used to be higher. Our cars are a lot better than they used to be as far as safety things and and you know the glass and the metal and the restraint systems and the bags and all the rest of that stuff, we're doing pretty good. We've made traveling much safer. That's a good thing. But still, at least 36,000 people are going to die because they got into a vehicle and somebody else got into a vehicle. So what are our standards for making these decisions? Are we literally to say, if there is any chance whatsoever that my actions could lead to the death of someone else, I can't do it? That's the end of society. It's the end of society. Remember those videos? It always scared me to death. But the pictures and videos from like 1900 through the 1930s in New York City, where you're building skyscrapers, and these guys are out there eating their lunch on this thing that's this wide, and there's nothing beneath that. I assure you, utterly impossible for me to do. That's even harder than watching Free Solo. Okay? I mean, when Alex Honnold got to the boulder problem in Free Solo, I'm not sure how many times I tried to watch through that before I could actually watch the whole thing. Because my hands are sweating. Well, Alex Honnold made it. A lot of those guys didn't. There were a lot of people who died building the buildings that some of you utilize to this day and don't really give it much of a second thought. Their names are probably chiseled on a block someplace if you ever look down the basement. But a lot of people died. And society made the decision that's an acceptable price to pay to have a big old honkin' city with big old tall buildings in it. So society makes these choices. And right now we're being faced with another choice. And without numbers, we can't even begin to make these choices. And as far as I can see, the vast majority of people that I'm watching and I'm reading have never even looked at a chart like this. They don't even know what the numbers are per year. They don't even know that we're talking about 2.8 million people are going to die in the United States over the course of 2020. Maybe a little more, especially as the population ages. Did you know the population, the average person in Italy, is more than 10 years older than the average person in the United States? Did you know that? Very aged society. Not replacing itself. Their birth rate is well below replacement. The Italian people will disappear at the current rate. That's, again, these are just numbers, facts. And so Andrew Sandlin has been trying to, in a calm, reflective fashion, to point people to a certain work of a scholar, award-winning scholar, who has discussed the difference between basically short-term thinking and long-term thinking, narrative thought and much more reflective thought. And I'm concerned that in light of the public educational system, we have a lot of people today that are totally on the narrative side, totally on the immediate outcome side. And the idea of sitting back and seeing long term just isn't there. But the only way you can do any kind of meaningful meditation upon these issues is to have some of the big numbers. Look them up. Look them up and consider that, for example, in 2020, how will these numbers change? Well, because of coronavirus, The influenza, now will that just be thrown into the influenza and pneumonia part? Will there actually be fewer influenza and pneumonia deaths in that category because coronavirus is given its own? But the primary way the coronavirus kills is by opening a pathway for pneumonia. So how do you even count it? But the point is, on an average year, I don't remember anything particularly spectacular in 2017. Certainly nothing like what we're experiencing now. Worldwide panic and everybody run for the hills. But in that year, nearly 60,000 people died of flu and pneumonia. That was only basically approximately one-third of how many died of accidents. So is there anything we could do to mitigate the two big ones, heart disease and cancer? I mean, that's almost half the number right there. Well, if we were really, really, really serious about, well, we can't have 10,000 people dying. That's 1/120th. Is that 1/120th? Small fraction of the people who die from heart disease and cancer. So why aren't we shutting down all the fast food restaurants? We know what causes a lot of this, so why aren't we doing it? Because we haven't made the decision to do that. Society as a whole, without knowing it, we didn't think through it, but society as a whole has made decisions. And that decision means that there's going to be 1.2 million who die of heart disease and cancer. And the thinking basically is, well, that's what happens as we get old. Something's going to get you one way or the other. Nobody lives forever. And so we make these decisions and then we live with them. And at least in my generation, you didn't sit there and blame the government for it. Because you didn't think the government had the responsibility of mitigating life. Unless it was the enemy's life, then that was under the War Department. Totally different thing. It just seems to me that there's not been much thought given to these numbers, to what the total numbers will be and what's going to cause them. Will be and what's going to cause them. Now, here in 2007, it said life expectancy 78.6. That's mixing men and women together. It is fascinating to break these apart. Women don't die in accidents nearly as much as men do because men are stupid. Okay? That's just the only way to put it. And that's why if you look at birth records, God knew that men are stupid. And so there are slightly more boys born than girls, as long as we don't murder people in the womb. And, of course, by the way, I wanted to mention this. This death and mortality list does not list a huge factor, abortions. Should, but CDC doesn't want to do that. Doesn't want to do that. But there were many, many, many more killed in that method. But so it doesn't differentiate between men and women. Women live longer than men do on average. That's been well known for a very, very long time. And so what I have heard is that since this, I think since 2019, at least 2018, the suicide rate has gone up so much that the life expectancy number has gone down for the first time, to my knowledge, in American history. Aside from times of war, and I'm not sure that they necessarily counted them into the general population. And, of course, back when you had things like the Civil War going on, the CDC didn't exist. So you don't have numbers for things like that. But there's some numbers that I went online, pulled them up, and said, what's there? And how do we think about things like this? And I think it's important for Christians to consider these things and to have a context. Now, some of you are sitting there making assumptions about what I must be saying. I must be saying this, that, or the other thing. And what I'm discovering is that right now in our society, if you do not think emotively, if you think long term, if you want data and statistics, then you are put into one camp and one category and condemned immediately as a result. I just gave you the numbers. I'm inviting you to think about it and ask yourself the question. The standard that is being applied right now. And yeah, I hate to use the term, but it's a cost-benefit analysis. It is. I'm not going to do that. Did you drive a car today? You did it. You can ignore it. You can deny it. You can say, I don't want to be told that I made a cost-benefit analysis. You made a cost-benefit analysis. Because your car is a deadly weapon. And in your cost-benefit analysis, it was more important that you get to go to a movie, go to the grocery store, go to the doctor, than the chance you might kill someone or be killed. You made that. You did it. Whether it was purposeful, knowledgeable, or based upon good information, I don't know. Just one other thing along these lines. I've had a little bit of a dry cough. A little bit of a sore throat. So I must have COVID-19. No, because when I went out to my car a couple days ago, my car had this yellow film on the windshield. You know what that's called? Pollen. It got up into the 80s here in Phoenix. Then we had a bunch of rain, and then it warmed back up again, and then we had a bunch of wind. And so this time of year, for a bunch of us, it's allergy season. But how many people are literally sitting there fighting not to cough? Because if I do, everyone's going to look at me because I'm the plague carrier. You know it's the way it is. You know it's the way it is. Don't get mad at me for pointing out. I could not believe that people got mad at me for one of the funniest tweets I've ever written yesterday. I had people coming after me. And the reason it was funny is because it's true. I said, last week, wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, and you'll be fine. This week, once the 10th person walks in the room, we nuke the site from orbit. Wow, that accelerated quickly. Now, that was funny. It really was funny. And it was even more funny if you saw Ridley saying, we need to take off and nuke the site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. Okay? There was I even had a social connection there to a movie. I should be given great credit for this because I normally don't do that, but I did. But oh my goodness, the people just evidently, even exposure to the COVID-19 virus that does not infect you still destroys your sense of humor. It's gone. It's out the door. It's history. Okay. All right. Let's completely change topic. And I had some people on Twitter when we were talking about, okay, we're all going to get locked in our houses soon, and that may happen. If we all get locked in our houses soon, what are we going to do? Well, a lot of people pointed out that homeschool families are going, nah, 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 and they are. They're just going right along and going social distancing. We are the experts. We are good at this. But some people said, hey, you should like teach a Greek class. And I'm like, dude, if this lasts that long, we're all toast. We are all toast if it lasts that long. But I thought it would be good, and I put this on Twitter, but let me just mention it here briefly. I think it's a wonderful idea for people to learn Greek or Hebrew on their own, and you can do it. It's rare, and I'll tell you why it's rare. It's rare because it takes discipline. It takes setting aside, and this is what a class provides you, setting aside a specific amount of time each and every day to be disciplined in using materials that are now available from various publishers. Mounce's system, and Zondervan has another system for Hebrew. Starts with a P, as I recall, something like that. It came out after I had been teaching Hebrew for a while. I didn't use it. I used Seattle, but now you can get the same stuff like you have for Mounce, but for Hebrew. The materials are there. The online materials are there. Tests, quizzes, lectures, it's all there. Most people just don't have the personal discipline because how busy our lives are or just what our choices are to be able to follow through. But if you have that desire, or if you're going to take a Greek or Hebrew class, let me give you the most important point of advice I can give you. I've taught both, and if I could have talked to all the students before they came into my class, 3 months before they came into my class, 4 months before they came into my class, and given them a pre-class assignment, could have had all the difference in the world. And this would be what the pre-class assignment is. In my experience, and I've talked with lots of other people who've taught these languages and they agree, in my experience, the biggest reason that people fail in learning Greek and Hebrew is because they don't know English first. Or if your mother tongue is another language, fine. But speaking to English speakers. So you pick up a grammar of Greek, and it's going to talk to you about participles. And if you aren't overly clear about what that is in your own language, what you end up doing is trying to learn two languages at the same time. And so what we call the fog of trying to learn new vocabulary, the fog of struggling with a different kind of grammar and syntax from another language, is greatly thickened if you're having to go, okay, now what's an infinitive again? I'm not sure what that is. And the grammars are going to assume some level of knowledge on your part of your own language. And so while you can obviously just grab your phone, go online, get a Greek vocabulary building program, and start working on what's called the 50-word vocabulary, the words that are used 50 or more times in the New Testament, which is generally what you get in first-year Greek. I'm not saying not to do that. I'm saying that's only going to be primarily helpful for people who already know their mother tongue. So if grammar is a struggle for you in English, it's not going to get any better when you take Greek. It's just going to make it even more complicated. So if that's something you're thinking about doing, if that's something you've thought about doing, then take my advice and learn your own language before you do anything else. Then the other thing you can do is if you've been laid off, there ain't much you can do. You can sit there and worry. You can sit there and watch your life savings drain away. I know. But you can also keep your mind, you can try to redeem the time. You can try to do some reading. Yes, actual books. You don't have to have a Kindle. There, it is possible to read the old style thing of made of paper. But most of these are available via Kindle now, too. So whatever floats your boat, that's fine. But just a couple recommendations. And these are obviously just stuff I grabbed off my shelf. People ask, well, what church histories should I read? Well, I've mentioned this one a number of times before. I finally grabbed it. And you can see by the condition it's in, see how yellowed the pages are. This was, and the fact that the spine's broken, and that entire portion, portions fall out. No, I ain't sending this to Jeffrey. No, I'm not wasting Jeffrey's time with this one. But you can see, you can always tell an active seminary book or college book by the fact that you can see it's been rubbed against other books. And this one has been. This is A History of Christianity, Volume 1, Beginnings to 1500, Kenneth Scott Lauderette, Revised Edition. Yeah, Revised Edition. I'm wondering what the date on this one was. 1975 or something like that. 1975. So this was, and it's volume one, so I have volume two as well. This was my primary church history text in seminary, Fuller Theological Seminary. Don't throw rocks. I did it in extension, so my church history professor was awesome. Lauderette, I have described as being as exciting as chewing on aluminum foil. Or aluminium, if you're outside the United States. But he's good. And he's thorough. Certainly readable. I don't think as exciting as Schaff, but smaller than Schaff. And one of the nice things about Lauderette is at least he made some effort to include information on the Eastern Church, which a lot of Western church histories just don't even bother to try to do. So Lauderette is good. Lauderette, you need to have Lauderette in your library if you're trying to build a church history library. Schaff, Lauderette, things like that. Very helpful. So I would suggest that, and I'll come back to it in a moment. But just overall church histories are sometimes, they're trying to do so much. The books on church history that I've found to be the most useful have been the books that were focused on a particular period. And so these little Pelican books, like here, Henry Chadwick's The Early Church, and I had, didn't Chadwick also do a Reformation one? Maybe it's somebody else. I'm not sure. Anyways, really, really useful. Very readable. Chadwick is an excellent writer. Obviously, this is a brief summary, but man, it's a good place to start. And then there are, there's always when you look at the index, when you look, suggestions for further reading, general surveys from Jerusalem to Rome, faith and order, expansion, et cetera, et cetera. That's the part where you can do some serious damage to your Amazon account is what you can do. Then it's always good to read original stuff. And so here's Michael Holmes. I read Lightfoot years ago, the green one that some of us older folks still have. That's where all my markings are. But The Apostolic Fathers by Michael Holmes has introductions and things like that. And obviously you put these two together, and you're getting the overall history here and then the specific writings. And you're going to, it's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag, as you would expect it to be. Not everybody writing here even had the entire canon of the New Testament. But it's always good I just popped this open. It just happened open to this because paperback and paperbacks do things like that. If therefore the Son of God, who is Lord and is destined to judge living the dead, suffered in order that his wounds might give us life, let us believe that the Son of God could not suffer except for our sake. From the Epistle of Barnabas, which is not the Gospel of Barnabas, which is a fake from the 13th, 14th century. Epistle of Barnabas is, well, earlier than that. You will find stuff that will excite you, and you will find stuff that will make you go, huh? All within the pages of stuff like that. It is always good to be reading straight up stuff like that. And then if you would like to be challenged, as it challenged me, if you would like to be challenged on many grounds, the mission of God, let's just put it this way. If this stuff happens for so long that you can finish this book, we're all doomed. Because that ain't a small book. Okay, it's, let's see, what are we looking at here? Just under 700 pages. Challenged me. I need to read through it again. But great stuff in there. Joseph Boots, bright guy. Now, one of the things that I mentioned was that Kenneth Scott Laudaret touched on an important aspect of church history. And that was, he touched on the Eastern church. But then notice, this is beginnings of 1500. So this is the volume that a lot of people would skip for one reason. They'd read the early church part and then they lose all interest. Because the general idea is there was nothing in the medieval period that is even relevant to us. Because our history sort of starts with Luther, doesn't it? Let me explain something to you. If you don't know what was going on before Luther, you'll never really understand Luther. And see, what's scary to me is people don't understand Luther. And they create caricatures of Luther and the reformers because they do not realize the world out of which they're coming. Not even out of which, but from that influenced them in their understandings and their training. So Luther especially receives a training that is steeped in medieval theology. And if you buy into the idea that the medieval period was dead, well, it's the Dark Ages, you know, there's no light. If you think there weren't any Christians, first of all, you're thinking in a way that the reformers never could have even begun to conceive of. Couldn't have conceived it. The reformers wouldn't even, modern King James only fundamentalists, a reformer would go, what are you people talking about? We have no way of even beginning to understand what you're talking about. The reformers found true gems. Even in the midst of saying, wow, there's been a lot of accretion of tradition and acceptance of unbiblical concepts and everything else, but they did not simply throw everything out from the generations that preceded them. They could critically analyze things. They could reject things. They did reject things. But if there was a period that the vast majority of even church history aware people need to spend more time in to understand. Who is Charles the Great? Who is Charlemagne? How is that important in the maintenance of even the ancient records of the world being preserved for us by the people who lived at that time, et cetera, et cetera. Let alone the theological streams that ended up coming into conflict during the Reformation. But just some suggestions as far as things that you might want to be reading. Only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to respond to, oops, start reading it and the entire screen goes blank. Wanted to respond to a, and see what this will do will help everybody pass the time during this crisis. If you can't go outside, you can't go anywhere. The best way to pass time is to start a meme war with Leighton Flowers. Because what better thing to be doing than to be talking about choice meats when you can't get any meat? You hearing the booing going on in the other room? Yes. Okay, now the entire studio audience is booing. okay. Actually, so you took it the same way I did. Leighton Flowers actually retweeted something I said positively, right? Yeah. So obviously the world is coming to an end. Why'd you do that? Why are you doing that? You've switched back and forth between two different cameras multiple times. How many years has he been doing this? I've lost track. It's just like forever. Maybe that's the problem. Test pattern. Most people have no idea what that is. We used to see that, remember? Before stations would come on the air. That's what you'd see. At midnight when it went off, yeah. Right, you'd wake up and you've got a beer and a test pattern, yep. And millennials and younger have no earthly idea what any of that is about. So, yeah, there you go. What was I talking about? Okay, Leighton Flowers, that's right. So, I haven't really noticed much in the way of response to the last two programs where we went rather in-depth in response to and it may be out there, but it's just been overwhelmed by everything else that's going on. That's understandable. Completely understandable. I'm not making any comments beyond that. But I did see this. All right, I'll try to. Can you blow that up? I'm not sure. Yeah, it's really small. That's really teeny tiny. I mean, it's not like it's real big. It'll probably fuzz out if you do try to blow it up very much, actually. Two tweets from Leighton Flowers written to Dr. David Allen. White can't seem to get the concept that the universal extent of the atonement isn't impacted by whether or not you think believers are elected on account of their faith or unconditionally before time, because its benefit is applied at the point of faith in time. 95% of White's rebuttal is based on this misunderstanding. When you couple that with his dismissive, condescending tone and bully-like taunts, I think that would mean let's debate. When you don't want to, it's called a bully-like taunt. I cannot imagine how further engagement would help. I pray a better example of Calvinistic scholarship will engage. Well, I did respond to this, and I said I can't get the concept because the concept is untrue. Notice what's being said. White can't seem to get the concept that the universal extent of the atonement isn't impacted by whether or not you think believers are elected on account of their faith or unconditionally before time because its benefit is applied to the point of time, of faith and time. Now, that didn't have anything to do with my argument if Leighton Flowers thinks it does, and Leighton Flowers had no idea what I was saying. The argument, as we pointed out and documented over and over again, is that from the, at least from David Allen's perspective, maybe he disagrees with Leighton Flowers, I don't know. But from Allen's perspective, the idea that that Paul is only referring to believers is vital because they are believers by a free will act. And therefore, that's how he deals with the prior nature of the election of God that chooses who the elect are going to be in the first place. That is a misreading of Paul. That is as establishing a rule that doesn't exist in any work on hermeneutics that I know of. Certainly never did not drive anything from the text. I'm the one that pointed out that the last time believers and believing was used was back in Romans 5. And so Alan uses that to basically say Paul can't be going back before the events of Romans 3 or 4 and the purview of that. He can't be talking about God's eternal purposes that lays the ground date, the ground and foundation of those things. Why not? That's exactly what he's doing, and that's what any meaningful exegesis demonstrates. But the point is that what this perspective requires you to believe is that, again, God's sovereign decree of salvation, which includes the identity of the elect, the regeneration of the elect, the granting of faith and repentance to the elect, can be separated out from the consideration of the audience of the atonement, the purpose of the atonement, and the result of the atonement. And this, again, is this idea that, no, we can't ask the New Testament to have any consistency in these things. We have to keep all these things separated from one another. That's, as I've said more than once, the strength and the power of Reformed theology is its ability to start at the beginning of a passage and work its way through. And to show how this interpretation is consistent with this over here and that over there, there is a narrative, there is a flow, there is an underlying consistency to what the apostles taught, what the prophets taught, and what Scripture teaches as a whole. So the universal extent of the atonement isn't impacted by whether or not you think believers are elected on account of their faith. What he's saying there is, don't ask God to be consistent. That's what he just said. Because if you do believe that the elect are chosen unconditionally, then that is going to be relevant to the issue of the extent of the atonement. Now notice what he's trying to say. Because its benefit is applied at the point of faith in time. But that's not when that is decided. Who decides what that time is? In the Reformed understanding, God does. God, as in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son. There was a fullness of time. There was a time when that was to happen. In the same way, when God chose, he broke into Paul's life and converted him. And that's the case with everyone. And so there is a perfect consistency between the intention and meaning of the atonement in redeeming God's elect people and the fact that it's only certain people who are going to be regenerated and given the gifts of faith and repentance. There is a consistency in Reformed theology that simply cannot exist in a synergistic system. And so they want to just insist, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. You're basically saying there cannot be a sovereign choice of God. And that, of course, is their perspective. They do not believe there can be a sovereign election on the part of God that is free and based solely upon his grace. It's just, that's the thing that they're really trying to get around. So there you go. There's something to start things off with. I hadn't talked to you about this, Rich, but, you know, I think we probably need to come back tomorrow.
I've been known to work on Wednesdays.
Eh?
I said I've been known to work on Wednesdays.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that'd be fine. I'm usually here. That's,
okay.
We can do that.
So, well,
did you notice what's behind me?
Notice what behind you?
You notice it was anything behind me?
I noticed the studio audience.
Oh, we have a studio audience.
I mentioned the studio audience.
Yes, you did, but they're behind me. I'm sure they're waiting.
Oh, I see. The rich cam. The rich cam.
Let's do that.
Oh, hey, okay. Look at that. You put the test pattern up.
Yeah.
Well, how much did they pay you to do that? Because I know her. She slipped you a 20 to do
we'll
that.
We'll do the rest of the show like this. No? Oh, okay.
Now, they slipped you a 20 to do that. I know that. I wonder what was going on in there. Now people can be calling up going, hey, how do I get tickets to do the audience thing?
Snuck in the back door, folks.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And notice they're at least 3 feet behind me.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I saw
so
you using
your
hand sanitizer. And
social distancing.
Social distancing. That's right. That's right. There are only 4 people in this part of the building.
Yes, that's right.
So please don't nuke us.
And we're awfully close as it is here in this part of the building. So
that's right.
You know.
That's right. That's right. All right. So, yeah, the plan is to try to do a little bit more on the dividing line to, hey, if you're stuck there, we'll try to be there with you. We'll try to be there with you. I'm not sure what we're going to talk about tomorrow, but we'll. Hey, we do have things called phones, and sometimes letting the listeners drive the direction can be absolutely fascinating. But I still need to get back to, if I can find time, to the foundations of Augustinian Calvinism too, with Ken Wilson. So we'll see what we can do about that as well. Thanks for watching the program today. We'll see you, Lord willing, tomorrow. God bless.